Well, good evening. It is very good to be here and to see all of you this evening. We are here picking up the story of Christ's ministry during the last 2 days prior to his crucifixion. Jesus was in Jerusalem teaching on the Sunday before Passover. He returned to Bethany, where that evening a woman anointed his feet with ointment. And then the following day on Monday is when Judas made a deal to betray Jesus to the chief priests. The following day on Tuesday was, of course, the time when the disciples made the physical preparations for the Passover and observed it with Jesus that Tuesday evening that began the events that led, of course, up to his arrest and his crucifixion. Now, let's pick up the story briefly here in Matthew 25. We sort of summarized some of this last time, but one of the things we were looking at is the fact that the events described here in Matthew 23, 24, 25 just run straight through. It's consecutive teaching. Chapter 24 picks it up when Christ left the temple. This was after his very strong rebuke of the Pharisees and his response to the disciples' questions about the end of the age and his return, the destruction of the temple. And then chapter 25 just continues the same discourse all the way down until you come to chapter 26, verse 1. Came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, you know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Now, this is where we get the timing of it, that this was let's say, the late Sunday afternoon as they were on their way back to Bethany that evening where they spent the night. Bethany's fairly short walk, I think not much over a mile, a little less than 2 miles, something of that nature. And so it was a fairly short walk. That would have been then that's where we get that this was on Sunday evening. Now, notice here in chapter 25, there are just a couple of things we want to pick up here. The parable of the talents. Jesus gave a number of parables of the kingdom, and chapter 25, verse 1 opens with the kingdom being likened to 10 virgins. And again, his point on the parable, he ends up in verse 13, watch, you don't know the day nor the hour. Then the next parable of the kingdom is the kingdom in verse 14 is likened to a man traveling into a far country, calling his servants and delivering them his goods. This is the parable of the talents. And we find in verse 8 and verse 19, after a long time, the Lord of those servants comes and reckons with them. Now, you know, Jesus gave this parable, and the disciples listened to it, and they didn't really pick up on the fact when he talked about giving the talents, and he said, after a long time, the Lord of the servants comes. Implying to them, of course, if they had really thought carefully of what he said, that the kingdom was not right now. He was going into a far country, and He it was after a long time he would return. But when he did, when he returned, he reckoned with them. There is a time of accountability. And we find, again, this matter of two different categories. The ones who had increased their talents. Of course, talent was an old Roman measure of money. It has entered the English language, referring to talent or ability as we think of it, basically from the King James Bible. It was an old measure of money and has come into English with a different sense, basically based on this parable. That's sort of where we get our modern usage of it. But in the context, he's describing, giving money, but the point is that there is an accountability. And what we see clearly brought out in verse 21 is that if we have been faithful over a little bit, ultimately we will be given rule over much. Whatever opportunities, whatever things we are given now that we have in this life is comparatively very little. And we're learning how to handle little things. And if we can learn to be faithful in the little things, then certainly we will be able to be trusted to be faithful in much. As you come on down, we find the unprofitable servant contrasted with the good and faithful servant. Then verse 31 picks up another story. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. Before him shall be gathered all nations, and he'll separate them one from another, as the shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. Now, one thing this shows is that when is the judgment of the nations going to occur? When the Son of Man comes in his glory, that's when he's going to sit upon the throne of his glory, and that's when these things are going to occur. That's when that judgment will take place. So it's not something that is necessary. It's not something that is occurring right now. And it's also a process. It's not just simply that Christ is going to. I think a lot of times people have this courtroom scene in their mind. Actually, the period of judging stretches through the entirety of the millennium and on through the White Throne Judgment period. It is a process of separating out the sheep from the goats. And the judgment period, when Christ returns, will begin that period of judgment that will continue on until everything has been judged. And the sheep will be invited to come and inherit the kingdom, and those who are classified spiritually as goats will be sent away into everlasting fire. And, of course, the point Christ comes down to, and I think the principle applies all the way along, because God is very consistent in the principles by which he judges. Christ said, when asked to summarize what was the greatest point of the law, he said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and your neighbor as yourself." Loving God with all your heart is the first and great commandment, and the second is likened to it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two hang all the law and the prophets. Christ emphasizes here that the way we treat one another is, in that sense, our attitude toward him. That is an important, an important concept. You could tie it in with a lot of things. James talks about those who have respect of persons. In other words, someone who looks important comes along and he's treated with great deference and is cultivated because he's wealthy, because he gives the appearance of that. Someone else who is clearly sort of down and out comes along, and he is treated in a totally different way. And is sometimes, even on a human level, people outsmart themselves that way. One of the best stories that I know of that fact involves a couple who, after the death of their son, He was their only son, and in the aftermath of his death, they made an appointment to see the president of Harvard University. And when they came in, they were not an impressive-looking couple. They weren't impressively dressed, and they had come to make a bequest. What they wanted to do was to have something that would be built that would bear their son's name. And the president of Harvard gave them very short shift. He took a look at them and decided they didn't have anything worth his time to be involved. And so he really would hardly give them the time of day. Wasn't interested in discussing the matter with him, so they didn't discuss it with him anymore. They endowed what became Stanford University. Their name was Stanford. He jumped to a conclusion based on outward appearance that I'm sure he later came to regret when he found out the amount of money involved. But that's a natural human tendency. James dwells on that because it was a tendency in the church, and he was very emphatic that you don't treat people differently in terms of showing kindness and deference to one because he's wealthy and just sort of ignoring or mistreating or considering as not worth anything someone who is very poor. And that point is made. James says you're becoming a respect of persons in that way. That's sin. In the law, Israel was enjoined, the judges in Israel were enjoined, that they should hear the small as well as the great, and that they should not show favoritism in judgment, either because someone was very wealthy or because someone was very poor, that they were to be fair and equitable in their judgment. Christ develops that same theme here, in a sense, by saying the way you treat others is the way you would treat me. You know, Jesus did not come. He was not born in a king's palace. He did not take upon himself the status of the heir to the Roman Empire or something of that sort. He was born into a humble family and certainly born in very humble surroundings. I mean, you go through and you read the story and there was no room in the inn, and so there may be a place out there in the barn. It was in a very humble surroundings. Now, if you were going to treat Jesus based on outward appearance, say, those people don't amount to much. They came here and just simply based on outward circumstances. So it comes out, this principle, that is certainly very important. I think one that we ought to certainly keep in mind, that Christ takes it personally, the way we treat others. You know, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. So the way we treat one another, maybe we don't think of it that way, but it's like, would you speak to Jesus Christ that way? Would you treat Jesus Christ that way? You know, the way you treat your neighbor, or your friend, or your husband, or your wife, or whomever. Inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. That's a pretty strong pronouncement. Christ finished these sayings. And then this, of course, was here pretty well at the end of Sunday. And we find that in the meantime, some of the religious leaders had assembled at the palace of Caiaphas and consulted how they might take Jesus with subtlety and kill him. They didn't want to do it on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. What they wanted to do was get rid of him, but they were afraid of doing it in a way that would make themselves look bad, that could provoke a riot, They didn't want to seize him there in the temple. You see, Christ had been very careful, and the only it was like he would sort of disappear from view, and the next time they knew where he was, he was standing there in the middle of a public place in the temple. There was a big crowd of people gathered around. So they either had to come up and make a great public display and try to seize him there in a big crowd, which could have provoked a riot. They were scared of that. And they couldn't find him elsewhere. They weren't sure where he was. So they were consulting this. Now, as we find a little later, Jesus was there in Bethany that evening, and we find a similar occurrence to what had occurred a few days earlier, where Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus, had come and anointed his feet with this very expensive ointment. Now, in the home of Simon the leper, a woman with an alabaster box, a very precious ointment, she poured it on his head as he was sitting there eating. She came in, and the disciples saw it. They had indignation. They said, "This is so wasteful." As you come on down, one of the other accounts brings out, you know, this could be sold for virtually a year's wages, at least, of a common laborer. This would have been the equivalent in our, let's say, society, or what we would think of as, you know, thousands of dollars, maybe $10,000 or something, if you want to sort of put it in a context that would you can understand. You know, why all of a sudden they were indignant. Here was this extremely expensive ointment that was poured out. It was gone, and they said, "Wow, this ointment could have been sold for much and given to the poor." And Jesus understood it, and he said unto them, he knew what they were saying. He said, "Why are you troubling this woman? She has wrought a good work upon me. You have the poor always with you, but me you don't have always. She's poured this on my body. She did it for my burial." And, you know, he made the statement, wherever the gospel is preached, what this woman has done will be told. So here's one specific thing that Christ insisted be set down in the gospel accounts and preserved forever. It's, you know, what you have described is here and earlier with Mary was an act of worship and devotion. An act of worship and devotion. And it was on a level that the disciples didn't fully understand. You know, they sort of looked at it that maybe these emotional women had just gotten carried away and wasted all his money. You know, that was sort of the way they viewed it. Jesus didn't view it that way. You know, he accepted it as an act of worship and devotion. He was God in the flesh. And, you know, maybe these women were emotional, but they perceived on a deeper level. They recognized something that hadn't even fully registered with the disciples. They had a grasp of what was going on and were touched so deeply and wanted to show that devotion and that worship to him. And, you know, it tells us something, I think, in terms of our attitude, an attitude of worship and devotion that we should have to the Father and to Jesus Christ. Now, this seems to have been the breaking point for Judas, because it was in the aftermath of this, most likely the very next day, that's why I would say on Monday, that he went to the chief priest and said, "What will you give me to deliver him?" And they made an agreement for 30 pieces of silver. And this was the... Judas was really indignant. You know, John told the account of what had happened a few days earlier at Mary and Martha's, and he mentioned that Judas was the one who led the protest. And then John added in the analysis. Judas really wasn't so much concerned for the poor as it was that he was a thief and he was the treasurer. And he knew if it was turned into cash, he would have it. He evidently had been griping and complaining because some of the disciples said this. So Judas's attitude had evidently rubbed off on some of the others. that they thought this was pretty wasteful too. And I don't know if Jesus looked Judas eyeball to eyeball when he said some of these things or not, but it seems that in the aftermath of that, Judas was so upset. You know, I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows exactly what Judas had in his mind. We do know this, that when Judas recognized that Jesus was actually going to be taken out and killed, Matthew 27:3, when Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself. Now, I don't know exactly what Judas thought was going to happen with all of this, but I'll tell you what my impression is. My impression is that Judas had a script and Jesus wouldn't read his lines. Judas had things figured out in terms of what he wanted him to do. Perhaps Judas thought that he could force him into a situation of having to set up the kingdom. You know, one thing we know, just in terms of the lists that are normally given, many of the apostles are paired together. Judas is normally paired with Simon the Zealot, or Simon the Canaanite, as he's called, Cananean, which refers to the Zealots, doesn't refer to the race or the ethnic group called Canaanites. He's normally paired with him. Was Judas, did he come from a similar type background? You know, the Zealots were sort of the right-wing militia movement of the day. They were the ones who were ready to resort to arms to get rid of the Romans. You know, was that where Judas was coming from? Did he was he upset because Jesus wouldn't actually do something? And maybe he thought he would manipulate him into a situation, into a confrontation with the Romans where he would have to display that power and he would have to actually establish this kingdom he'd been talking about. I don't know exactly, but my impression when you put the story of Judas together, and particularly what it says in Matthew 27, is Judas had a scenario in his mind, and it didn't work out quite like he had in mind at all, because he evidently was not expecting to see Jesus actually taken out and executed. And he was so upset in the aftermath of that, of his plans gone awry. But the point was, he could not accept Jesus for who and what he was. He wanted a Jesus that would conform to be like he wanted him to be. Judas became increasingly upset with Jesus. That, I think, is very clear. Jesus wasn't just like Judas wanted him to be. You know, Judas had been there. He had been in the boat and saw him walking on the water. He had seen him multiply the loaves and the fishes. He saw him raise Lazarus from the dead. Judas himself had been imbued with power when Jesus sent the 12 out. And Judas had preached the gospel, and he had laid hands on the sick and healed them, and he had cast out demons. You go back and you read the account, and the disciples came back and they were so excited. They said, even the demons were subject to us in your name. No indication that Judas was the only one that couldn't do that. So, you know, you have to conclude, here was a man who had intimate contact with the Son of God, day in and day out, for 3 years, over 3 years. Had seen incredible miracles take place right in front of him. He had heard Jesus' teaching. He had actually been used of God to accomplish miracles himself. And yet, he became very embittered to the point he was prepared to betray Jesus. Clearly, because Jesus didn't conform to exactly the way Judas thought he ought to be. You know, sometimes there are those who are very controlling. They want to write the script and have everyone else read the lines. And, you know, life doesn't usually go that way. For some reason, it becomes a little bit like herding cats. You can't get them all lined up and marched in the same direction. And, you know, when you keep trying, all you do is get more frustrated. Judas not only became frustrated, he became embittered took a step that he, in his own mind, thought was going to fix things, going to solve things, whatever scenario or plan he had in mind, and the thing blew up in his face. I think there are a lot of lessons there, because it's easy for us to read a story and always identify with the good guys and never identify with the bad guys. We identify with Moses, not with Korah. We identify with David, not with Absalom. We identify with Jesus, not with Judas. But you and I know in our own personal lives, have you done everything perfectly since the time you were baptized? Have you ever sort of pulled something that would put you more in the category of the bad guys than the good guys? If we look at some of these things and seek to sort of put ourselves to understand how these people got in that situation, they didn't have some totally unique brand of human nature that they had the copyright on that none of the rest of us ever... people are basically tempted by the same things. They may handle the temptation differently. If we look at some of these things and understand how these individuals, whoever it is, this is the story we're going through right now, but you can apply it to any situation, how did those people get themselves in that sort of mess? Of course, then we can turn around and look and say, well, how have I gotten myself in some of the messes I've gotten myself in? And they're lessons, because if you ever see and understand the principle on something, then you can apply it to a whole wide range of specific situations. If you see the principle. And, clearly the principle here was to accept Jesus as he chose to define himself, not to try to do the defining ourselves, and to find that sometimes, the way that seemed logical to us is not necessarily the way God does it. Now, verse 17, this statement is confusing to many people, and if you have a King James Bible, you notice that some of the words are in italics. Verse 17 reads in the King James, "Now the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus." If you look at what's in italics, what it literally says is now the first of the unleavened, or the first of the unleavened bread. The translators jump to a conclusion here, and the impression is given that it was the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which would have been the first holy day, and yet the first holy day comes on the 15th day of the first month, and that's the day after the Passover, not the day before. So, what is the story? Because if the Passover is not celebrated until the evening that begins the 14th, then this is clearly the daylight portion of the 13th. Why would that be called the first of the unleavened bread? Well, the answer is that it was just that. It was the first of the unleavened bread. In most of the towns and villages, there were large public ovens where most of the people did their baking. And the rule was that at noon on the 13th, that any baking of leavened products had to cease. The public ovens were cleaned, and in the aftermath of that, beginning that afternoon, only unleavened bread could be baked there. Now, they had not yet gotten rid of all the leavening. They basically gathered it up on the 13th, and the custom was that afternoon on the 14th, just a matter of a few hours before sunset and the beginning of the holy day, shortly after noon on the 14th, they actually had a burning of the leavening. If you lived in a community where everybody kept the days of unleavened bread, you couldn't put yours in the trash. Why would the trash men want to haul something like that away? They burned it and basically gathered it up So the 13th was the day of unleavened bread. It was the day when they began baking the unleavened bread, which would then be used, some of it would be used at the Passover service that evening, and then it would be what would be available for the holy day in the afternoon of the 13th and the daylight portion of the 14th. Unleavened bread would be being baked in preparation for the holy day. So it was an expression that that's why the 13th came to be known as the first of the unleavened bread, because it was the first day that unleavened bread for the feast was baked, and it was when they began the unleavening. And that is when the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" Now, you know, there are those who claim that Christ, on his last Passover, changed the time of the Passover, that he celebrated the Passover a day early, or celebrated a meal with his disciples. It really wasn't the Passover, but it was in anticipation. And you hear all this stuff and read all these explanations. I think if you just look at the text, the disciples came to him and said, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" So they were clearly expecting to eat Passover with Jesus at the time that they did. There's no hint that they were in any way surprised by the timing. I can't imagine that Jesus would have told them to go and prepare the Passover on a different day than they had ever done it, and nobody, not even Peter, would have piped up and said, "Well, Lord, you know, this is the wrong day, isn't it? Why are we doing it tonight? That's supposed to be tomorrow night." I mean, that's, you know, that's incredible. Can you imagine? They questioned him about a whole lot less than that. They certainly didn't understand about the crucifixion and the resurrection. They didn't really grasp it until it was all over with. You know that as you go through the account. So they weren't expecting to do something early. They were clearly doing what they were accustomed to doing at the time they were accustomed to doing it. And he told them to go and to the city and gave them instructions as to what they were to do. The disciples did as Jesus had appointed them, verse 19, and they made ready the Passover. That's what they celebrated. They didn't celebrate some other thing. They made ready the Passover. And when evening was come, he sat down with the 12. And they ate. Now, let's look at the parallel accounts. In Mark chapter 14, when again, you have the story of the anointing in Bethany and Judas's betrayal. And verse 12, the first day of unleavened bread when they killed the Passover. So this is the same thing. You see, not the feast of unleavened bread, but it was the first day in which they baked unleavened bread. It was when they killed the Passover. The disciples said, "Where do you want us to go and prepare to eat the Passover?" And he sent them forth, and they went and prepared the upper room, and they made ready the Passover, verse 16. And when evening was come, he sat down with the disciples. As you may be aware, in the Hebrew, the term, this is not in the Greek, but in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, when they were initially commanded to kill the Passover lamb, to kill it in the evening, as it says in Exodus 12, the term literally in the Hebrew meant between the two evenings. Now, that's interesting. Some people try to argue around as to different things. You know, the Bible defines its own terms. And a lot of times, if you want to know what something means, look at the way it's used elsewhere in Scripture. That expression, between the two evenings, is used to refer to two other things other than a Passover celebration. Passover was to be celebrated between the two evenings. You know what else occurred between the two evenings? One, there in Exodus, where the quail came at sunset,
And we're told that they ate of the quail in the evening. The literal Hebrew is between the two evenings. The other place is very interesting. It's in Leviticus. When Aaron was given instructions about the lamps in the tabernacle, that he was to light the lamps in the tabernacle in the evening. The literal Hebrew is he was to light the lamps between the two evenings. Now, when would you light the lamps? Basically, between, as some of the translations render it, at twilight, at dusk, after sunset, and before total darkness. You know, those who want to say, well, between the two evenings, that means between noon and sunset. Why would you go light lamps between noon and sunset? You're going to light them at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? No. The logical explanation, you know, the Passover was celebrated at the same time that Aaron lit the lamps in the tabernacle and that the children of Israel ate the quail after they had arrived at sunset. You don't have to consult some medieval rabbi to get the interpretation of the word. The Bible gives the simplest interpretation just by its use of the term. And those are the only places that between the evenings is used, referring to the Passover, the eating of the quail, and the lamps being lit in the tabernacle. So this is when they prepared it. This is when they were there to eat of the lamb. And again, Luke 22 gives a parallel account. Verse 7, then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed. Again, the reference clearly not to the holy day, but to the day of the 13th, when the day of unleavened bread and the Passover will be killed there at the close of that day. He sent Peter and John, saying, go and prepare us the Passover that we may eat. And they asked him where. They didn't ask him why or when. They said where. And verse 13, they made ready the Passover. Verse 14, and when the hour was come, he sat down and the 12 apostles with him. He said, with desire, I've desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. He understood that he was actually going to fulfill the symbols of what they were doing. He knew that he was the Lamb of God come to take away the sins of the world. But it says, when the hour was come, Jesus did this at the appropriate time. Well, as we see that they sat down, let's look at John's account. The way it's translated in the King James is a little little misleading. As you look at the story, because at first glance you would think that verse 2 is rendered in the King James, supper being ended. But the better rendering is that supper was taking place. It was in process. Just even the context shows that, because as you come on down, they are still eating after the foot washing takes place. Jesus, after he had completed this foot washing, they're continuing to eat, mentions here, because verse 26, Jesus answered, he it is to whom I give a sop when I have dipped it. And he dipped the sop and gave it to Judas. And so the meal was still going on after the sop Satan entered in, and Judas got up to leave. When he had received the psalm, verse 30, he went immediately out. It was night. So this is on in the evening, but they're still sitting at the table eating. The sop was a piece of bread that had been broken off and dipped into the common dish. And Christ, you might think of it as like at a, you go to a Mexican restaurant, and, you know, they serve chips and salsa, and you dip the, you know, into the salsa, and you could eat it yourself or hand it to someone. A piece of bread was broken off, dipped into the this bowl that was there, and he handed it to Judas. And so clearly the meal was in progress during this time. They had already sat down, and Jesus, verse 4 of John 13, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. So, during the course of the meal, I think in context, certainly the earlier part of the meal, he got up and he began to wash their feet. And of course, Peter was very indignant and said, "You're not going to wash my feet." And that was because Peter didn't really understand the spiritual significance, but he was embarrassed because foot washing was a lowly task, and it was normally carried out by the junior servant, as it were. You ever notice when people have something they don't want to do, they always pass the buck? And if they've got somebody that's under them, they sort of pass it to him. And so it was a job that was normally relegated to the lowliest member of the household. That's not some great prestigious thing. Sit down and wash somebody's old dirty feet. The disciples came in, and of course, it had also a very practical value at that time in that age when you've been out walking quite a bit. Feels good. It's refreshing when be able to soak your feet a little bit. Feet would commonly be dirty, having picked up travel stains as they walked and wearing sandals. Even though, just from a purely human and physical standpoint, it would have felt good, none of them offered to wash the feet of everybody else when they got in there for supper. There weren't any servants there, and none of them volunteered. Here, Peter, why don't you sit down? John, let me wash your feet. You know, I bet that'll feel good. No. They had been arguing a little earlier as to who was going to have the highest job in the kingdom. The last thing in their mind was to sit down and say, why don't I just wash your feet? Because I bet that'd sure make you feel good. You get the setting of it, and when Jesus got up and started doing it, the first thought that came into their mind was not, "Oh, this is a new religious ceremony we're supposed to have." They were embarrassed. They didn't quite know what to make of it. It was unsettling to them. Here was the one they looked to as their teacher, as their master in that way, that they had acknowledged as the Messiah, the King of Israel. And he was kneeling down, performing the job of a servant, something that they hadn't even thought of doing for one another. And when he finished, he told them, verse 14, "If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. I've given you an example that you should do as I've done unto you. Servant isn't greater than his Lord." You know, that had a real impact on them that evening, and certainly as time went by and they thought about it, even more so. But if you can sort of put yourself in the picture and realize what foot washing signified, and he not only did it, but he told them they were to start doing it, to wash one another's feet. And they weren't greater than he was. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. You see, after he had washed their feet, verse 12, he took his garments and was sat back down at the table. And then he began to talk to them about it. And as they went on a little further, they were still eating. The meal was still taking place. And this is when Satan entered into Judas, and Judas left. I think clearly as you take the context of John 13 and John 13:30 particularly and put it with the other gospel accounts, Judas was there for the foot washing, but he left before the institution of the bread and the wine as a special symbol. I mean, there was bread and wine on the table along with the lamb and the other things that made up the traditional Passover meal. Jesus introduced special symbolic significance to bread and wine. I think the clear indication of the other gospel accounts was basically after the meal part, the meal was pretty well over. That had sort of wound down because as you go back and you read the accounts, I don't think that they just continued on drinking and eating and doing those things. Bread that was there, broke it and told them that this represented his body. Then he took the cup and blessed it, told them that represented his blood shed for them. And that part, if you go back to, well, let's just look at Matthew's account for the parallel that verse 26, you know, talks about as they were eating, and I think the sense of the story is they must have been getting toward the conclusion of the meal, and Jesus took the bread and blessed it and took the cup, and then you know, he explains about it, and then verse 30, when they sung a hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. So the indication is that was right at the conclusion of the meal. What Christ changed was not the time of the Passover, but the symbols of the Passover. And Judas went out around that time. That's when he went to the priest. He must have known what was going to happen. You know, it says Satan entered into Judas. Judas made himself vulnerable to Satan by his attitude. I think that's one thing that's important to understand. It's not like Satan can just totally come and go at will, but their attitudes and frames of mind that invite the influence of Satan and his demons. Mr. Armstrong used to give the analogy of like tuning in a radio station, and I think that's a very descriptive analogy, because we can, by our mood and our attitude, either tune in or tune out Satan. You know, when you go back to King Saul, you know, when he began to have trouble with demon spirits, I mean, first, what had happened to him? What made him susceptible? He was eaten up with certain attitudes of jealousy and fear and resentment. Negative attitudes and feelings made him receptive to Satan's influence. For a while, King David, who was not king, just a shepherd boy at the time, could come and play music, and it says the evil spirit left. You know, you can create any mood or atmosphere you want with music. You can create a very positive, upbeat mood. You know, you can rock a baby to sleep, or you can play reveille and roll the soldiers out of bed and into formation. I mean, you can do a lot of things with music. A very interesting quote, mine, I'm giving you sort of a paraphrase of it, but it was something that Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, recognized in his book, The Republic. His basic statement was, I don't care who makes the laws of the land if you let me make the music. That's interesting. I mean, that's not a modern concept. I would just ask you, who do you think had the greatest impact on American culture, Western culture, of the last half of the 20th century? Can you name me any senator, any congressman, or any governor who had as much influence on shaping the culture of the United States and the Western world than did Elvis Presley and the Beatles? Name me any congressman, any senator, any governor that had a larger impact in terms of shaping the popular culture of the last half a century. You know, Plato wasn't all wrong by any means. It doesn't matter who makes the laws as much as it matters who makes the music. I think it's interesting that 2,500 years ago, somebody perceived that and recognized the impact that could be had. It says something. Well, we've sort of gotten off the subject, haven't we? But the point, coming back to the subject, the point is that there are moods, there are atmospheres that can tune us in or tune us out. There were things that helped Saul for a while. He finally got in such bad shape that nothing was any help. But, you know, what we have to recognize is Judas became susceptible to Satan entering in because Judas had first gotten into a state of mind where he was receptive to Satan's influence. You know, our adversary goes about as a roaring lion seeking whom he might devour. Judas had gotten into an attitude and a frame of mind that was like hanging out the welcome sign on the front door, saying, come on in. And Satan did. It's an important lesson for us to learn that their moods and their attitudes that are dangerous because they extend an invitation. And so anyway, Satan went out. The context, really, of the of events of the foot washing, you want to know sometimes how much impact something makes. If there's anybody that had a reason to get discouraged, certainly Jesus did. Luke 22 tells the story. Here we are at the end of the meal. Foot washing had taken place, the bread and the wine, and verse 24, there was a strife among them which of them should be accounted the greatest. they were really sort of arguing and trying to get one up on one another. And he explained to them that the one who was really the chief, you know, the one that was greatest, was the one that served the most. And then he went on to tell them, verse 29, I appoint unto you a kingdom as my Father appointed unto me. You'll sit and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you'll sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So that was ultimately their destiny. They were going to judge the 12 tribes. He appointed them a kingdom. It involved real rulership, but it was rulership from a godly standpoint, from a servant standpoint, from a shepherd standpoint, not the way they had seen some of the Romans and others strutting around and their concept. You know, if you're going to get your concept of what it means to be a king from somebody like Herod, then you weren't going to have a very godly concept. And as you come on down through the story, Christ said to Peter in verse 31 of Luke 22, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat. I've prayed for you that your faith fail not. And when you are converted, strengthen your brethren. When you're converted. Peter wasn't converted yet. Peter immediately piped up and said, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. And Jesus said, before the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times. And of course, Peter didn't think that could ever happen. You know, I think there was a very vital lesson for Peter to learn in all of this. Peter relied, he was a strong man, and he relied on his own strength. He did not recognize how desperately he needed God's help and God's power. That's often a hard lesson for a strong person to learn. To accept their weakness and to recognize that I don't care how strong you are, human strength has a breaking point. God's strength doesn't. You know, if Peter had realized in what desperate shape he was, he'd have spent those 3 hours a little later on praying instead of sleeping. Christ prayed with intense concentration because he knew that he needed special help from the Father in a very special way. Peter and James and John may have prayed a few words. They dozed off and went to sleep. They had no sense of desperation. But Peter learned a lesson, I think, as a result of finding himself in a situation where he did what he never thought he would do. I think Peter learned a lesson that night that he never, ever forgot. You don't ever find this sort of thing happening to him again. Because I don't think Peter ever just went into something just simply relying on his own strength. And, Christ checked to sort of see that there were swords, found out there were two. It was not uncommon, as you traveled through the roads and the paths and everything like that, there were, sometimes wild animals, different things that weapons would be taken along for. And he just wanted to make sure that there were a couple of them there because he knew, given the circumstances, what would happen later on. He wanted things to play out. Of course, Peter did just what Christ knew he would do and what Peter didn't think he would do. Here in the remaining part of Luke 22, we have where Christ prayed intensely to the Father, and then coming on down his arrest. We'll come back to that, but let's go look briefly at John right now. John records what the others don't. The details that most of the rest of them give had already been given in 3 Gospels. John did not repeat all of that. But in John 13, John records what Jesus told them in a way that none of the others recorded. John, in retrospect, looked back and what Jesus said that evening, some of which was said there in the room before they left, most of which was said on the way as they walked from the upper room there in Jerusalem on out of town through the city gate, across the Kidron Valley, and up onto the Mount of Olives to the Garden of Gethsemane. And then prayer that Jesus prayed. It's recorded in John 17. But John 13, 14, 15, 16, certain details. John records in John 13, 34, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I've loved you, that you also love one another. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, if you have love one to another. And that you ought to love people, that wasn't new. The law said back in Leviticus 19, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. What was new is that as I've loved you, you should also love one another. This goes beyond loving your neighbor as yourself. We're to love our neighbor as ourself, but we're to love the brethren as Christ loved us. This is with a sacrificial love. And Christ said that love was to be a hallmark of his disciples. Now, there are other things that are to be a hallmark or to be descriptive. It's not enough just to have some of the description. It's required to have all of it. We're not truly his disciples if we don't love one another. And then Christ began to tell them, chapter 14, don't be troubled. He had said some things that were beginning to bother them. They didn't fully understand the implications of it, but he just said, look, you believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions.
if it weren't so, I would have told you. I'm going to prepare a place, and if I go and prepare a place, I'll come again and receive you to myself. Now, there are several things that come out. One, what most people don't realize is that in a literal sense, the Father's house was referenced to the temple. It's written, my Father's house is to be a house of prayer for all nations, but you've made it a den of thieves. Now, they were familiar with the temple. Most people don't realize that there were apartments in the temple. The way the temple was built was on the two sides and the back. There were three stories of apartments. Back in, 1 Kings 6, verse 5. Against the wall of the house he built chambers round about. Against the walls of the house round about, both of the temple and of the oracle, he made chambers round about. And describes the these chambers. Go to Jeremiah 35. Word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, verse 2, go unto the house of the Rechabites, speak unto them, and bring them into the house of the Lord, into one of the chambers. And so, verse 4, I brought them into the house of the Lord, into the chamber of the sons of Hanan, the son of Igdaliah, a man of God. And it was by the chamber of the princes, which was above the chamber of Maaseiah, the son of Shallum, the keeper of the door. Now, the point being that there were chambers, there were rooms or apartments in the Father's house, in the temple. And those chambers or apartments were assigned based on office. The high priest had a certain chamber, the doorkeeper had a certain chamber, this one had a certain chamber, that one. These chambers were assigned based on your office, on your position. Christ, the temple was a type of something. Christ was drawing an analogy that the disciples understood. They didn't think that they were going to go floating off to heaven. He said, you know, in my Father's house there are a lot of chambers, a lot of apartments. Well, yeah, they knew that. He said, well, I'm going to prepare a place for you. You see, the temple that's built without hands, as it describes, Paul terms it. I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm going to come again and receive you to myself, and where I am, there will you be also. Well, he didn't say you were going to go to heaven. He says, I'm going to come back to you. And Christ told them he was the way. He was leaving them his peace, verse 27. In chapter 15, he says, I'm the true vine. And he draws the analogy of branches, you've got to be attached to the vine in order to bear fruit. If you're not attached to the vine, then you wither up, and the only thing you can be used for, the only thing a branch can be used for is for firewood, unless it's attached to the branch and the sap is flowing through it and it's bearing fruit. So he says, abide in me and I in you. Branch can't bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine. No more can you except you abide in me. I'm the vine, you're the branches. If you abide in me and I abide in you, you'll bring forth much fruit. Without me, you can do nothing. You know, there's no such thing as how can you be an independent Christian? You've got to abide in Christ. You can't be independent in that way, because if you're not attached on to Christ, the true vine, then that's where our ability to bear fruit comes from. Real spiritual fruit is not born in our lives just by human willpower. It is Christ living in us. So he talks about abiding in Christ, and our words, his words, abiding in us. Call the disciples friends. Again, emphasize to them that they were to love one another. The world would hate them, but that's okay. Another thing he emphasizes in verse 16, he says, "You've not chosen me, but I've chosen you and ordained you or selected you that you should go and bring forth fruit." So it's not that we found Christ, it's that he found us. That's important for us to understand. We have been chosen. The word elect and the word choose are the same term. That's what elect is to elect is to choose. You know, when we're told to make our calling and election sure. Who is it that's with Christ at his coming? Those who are called and chosen and faithful. You and I have to make our calling and election sure by remaining faithful. He that endures to the end, the same shall be saved. So that's our part, is to remain faithful. God does the calling and God does the choosing. You know, the call goes out and God chooses certain ones, but ultimately we have to remain faithful. Christ talked about the persecution that would come. The world didn't know him, didn't know us. In chapter 16, he goes on and talks about some of the problems that will come. They'll put you out of the synagogue. Time will come when those who kill you will think they're doing God a service. They do this because they haven't known me and they haven't known the Father. They don't really know God. They may talk about God. They may think they do. There's a big difference between thinking you know about God and really knowing God. Emphasized to them that it was expedient for him to go away because he would send the Comforter, the Holy Spirit. And referred to it as the Spirit of Truth in verse 13. He says down in... talked about people being scattered, or his disciples were going to be scattered that evening, how they would scatter and leave him alone. But he said in verse 32, "I'm not alone because the Father's with me. These things have I spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you'll have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." He says, you don't have to worry. I've overcome. I have won. I have accomplished chapter 17 records Christ's prayer to the Father, one part of his prayer that was prayed that evening. He prayed in verse 11, "Holy Father, keep through your own name those whom you've given me, that they may be one as we are." You know, Christ said, "I and my Father are one." Well, you know, people can get all bent out of shape trying to figure out what that means. Well, we can be one just as Christ and the Father are one. That's what Christ said here in John 17:11. And verse 21, "that they all may be one. As you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they may be one in us." Talking about a complete unity of mind and spirit. When he spoke these things, John 18, he went over the brook Kidron, where this garden was. And this Judas knew the place because Jesus often went there. And Judas had gotten together this band of soldiers, and they came there to arrest Jesus. And John adds in a couple of details that the others don't. He mentions in verse 10 that it was Peter that had the sword, and that he smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. And the servant's name was Malchus. So this was, you know, Peter was a little bit on the quick-tempered side, and his first response was pull out his sword and go to it. I don't think he was just trying to slice the fellow's ear off. I think he gave a whack, you know, and the fellow dodged and it chopped his ear off. And as the other gospel accounts mention, Jesus healed the ear.
you know, picked it up and stuck it back on. Must have made quite an impression, you know. You know, can you imagine what was going through Malchus's mind in the aftermath of that? All these things had to happen pretty quickly together, but you know this was turning over in his mind as all of a sudden this sharp pain, he looks and hears his ear laying on the ground. Next thing he knows, Jesus reaches down, picks it up, and puts it back on. Everything's fine. Now he's arresting Jesus and hauling him off. He's the high priest's servant. He probably gets to witness the whole trial. Can you imagine what sort of turmoil is going on in his mind? Can you imagine how unnatural what Jesus did was? What do you think you and I would feel like doing if somebody has come and they are arresting you? Not for something you've done. They're arresting you. They're planning on hauling you off and giving you a trumped-up trial and killing you. And somebody else hurts one of the people who's doing this to you. Is your first thought going to be to pray for their healing? I think, good, you know, that guy sure got what he had coming. You know, there's an awful lot packed in there in terms of the kind of mercy and love that Jesus Christ extended. And where do you have the mind of Christ? You know, I don't know about you, but I don't know that that's just the first thing that pops in my mind. And yet, as we're growing to have the mind of Christ, that's what needs to be, that kind of love, that kind of mercy. And as you come on down through the story, the events of the... we find that Christ was taken away, verse 13, to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. And this is Peter followed after Christ, and the other disciple, as he's called here, which is, as you go through the context, that's the way John always referred to himself. And John evidently was acquainted with the was known to the high priest, verse 15, and he went in with Jesus to the palace of the high priest, and Peter stood at the door without. And then the other disciple that was known to the high priest came, spoke to the doorkeeper, and they brought in Peter. And I don't know if Peter was pleased with that or not, because a little later somebody said, "Hey, you are one of his disciples, aren't you?" And Peter said, "No." And a little later it was cold, and they were standing there, and Peter warmed himself, and you know, again the same thing. Let's go back in Matthew 26, a little bit of wrap up. Just notice one thing, that when they came to Gethsemane, Matthew 26, 36, Christ told the disciples to sit there and he would go and pray. And he took Peter and James and John, and he began to be sorrowful and very heavy. And he said unto them, "My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Wait here. Watch with me." You know, he just began to have this overwhelming sense of heaviness, of dread, of just a sense of feeling anxious and depressed. Just all of the things that were going on, that were churning around in his mind. How did Jesus deal with that? He went and fell on his face and he prayed, "Oh, my Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Came to the disciples, found them asleep, said to Peter, couldn't you even watch with me an hour? Watch and pray that you don't enter into temptation. The spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. Went again the second time and prayed, "Father, if this cup may not pass away from me except I drink it, your will be done." Came, found them sleepy again. And he left them and went away again, and he prayed the third time. And basically the same thing. When he came to the disciples this time, he said, "Sleep on, take your rest, the hour is at hand." You know, the sense of it, then verse 46, you know, "Come on, get up.
He is at hand that does betray me.
You get the idea as you read this in Matthew 26 that over the period of this 2 or 3 hours that a complete change had come about in Jesus' mood. He was heavy. He was feeling depressed and just in inner turmoil. But what did he do? He absolutely turned loose of self-will. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. There is a serenity and a peace that comes from surrender and acceptance. And it comes from no other place. When Christ turned loose, he had an inner peace. He came on the third time, he woke him up and he says, come on, let's go. He was ready to meet his fate in a way that earlier he had been struggling and agonizing. You know, there are times when you're going through something, when you're in turmoil and just you're anxious and everything's just knotting up inside. If you can come to the point where you turn loose, there's peace. This is the way it works. And it really does. There is a peace that comes that from knowing that you've turned loose. You're not trying to control the outcome. You put it in God's hands. You've accepted God's will. And there's a peace, there's a serenity that comes from surrender that can come from nothing else. And that is a crucial thing, because there's a lot of anxiety we carry with us in life because we keep trying to work things out and control the outcome. And the outcome, if you turn loose trying to control it and you put it in God's hands, there's a peace that comes because you know you've surrendered. And there's an awful lot packed into these few verses that I think could be helpful and beneficial to all of us at different times in our life. Well, they arrested Jesus and took him off to trial, led him to Caiaphas, verse 57. The trial was totally illegal. Verse 59 sums that up. There are many places, many sources you can go to show a variety of illegal things. But verse 59 says, the chief priests and the elders and all the council sought false witnesses against Jesus to put him to death. They found none. Yes, many false witnesses came, but they didn't find any because they had to get two that told the same story. You know, here's the crazy thing. Here are people that on the one hand were wanting to be so meticulous, well, the law says we have to have two witnesses. And on the other hand, they were prepared to bribe false ones. I mean, it's really crazy what the human mind can do. How things can be rationalized. They would have never thought of condemning him on the mouth of only one witness because the law said you had to have two. But they sought false witnesses against him. Now, why doesn't your conscience bother you to get a false witness? It's like you got to go through the color of law. But here's clearly an illegal trial. They are looking for false witnesses. Their mind is made up in terms of the results that they think they need. They have decided what they want. And these were religious people. They had rationalized and justified their conduct to where if you had asked any of these men, do you think the law has been done away? They would have been horrified. Oh, no. They were very observant of the law, the Torah. Well, what about the commandment that says, thou shalt not bear false witness? You know, the point is that people can sometimes rationalize and justify conduct that is incredible. Be very strict on one point and just totally miss the whole point. Strain a gnat and swallow a camel. There is a great deal that we often go through, always, I guess, go through at least some of this here prior to Passover, but I think it's good. I've wanted to focus in on a few other things and principles this evening that hopefully can be of help to us as we look at the
different different aspects, different lessons we can learn. So with that, we'll be concluded this evening.